Hello, I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager, and welcome to the In Conversation With series, a series where I speak to notable figures in the realm of financial services. Listen as they share their personal journeys, thoughts on the industry, and advice for aspiring advisors. Today, I'm joined by Richard Denning, CEO at M&G Wealth Platform. So Richard, if you could give us a more in-depth introduction, that would be great.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Thanks for tuning in and listening. So as Kimberly said, it's Richard Denning. I'm the CEO of M&G's Wealth Platform. Started my career at the mighty Prudential back in 1987, which is literally a lifetime ago. Trained as a general insurance underwriter, first of all. So for those old enough that remember the storms in 87, that was a baptism of fire, being in a general insurance business. Stayed at the Prudential, moved into life and pensions in the Pru, and always been in operations, project management and change really for a long time. Moved to Reading. And then got offered a job at a business that's ultimately become Phoenix, who at the time, its original incarnation was a business called Britannic in Birmingham. Worked at Britannic for a while. I left before it became Phoenix, but Britannic, I got offered a job in a platform. So at the in 2001, I didn't even know what a platform was. I literally thought it was something you stood at when you wanted to catch a train.
Yeah.
I went to work for a guy called Brett Williams at Old Mutual. So Brett was the Brett's now the managing director, CEO of SCI in the UK. Find I'm surrounded by people that I've known for a very long time, to be fair. And actually, it's interesting going back to M&G because it obviously owns the Prudential UK and seeing people that are still there. That's very, very surreal. But yeah, and I've been in platforms ever since. So what's now the Quilter platform was a startup business in 2001. Stayed there till 2008. Worked with a legend of platform, Bill Vasiliev, and a few other people to form another platform in 2008, Novia. Novia did a kind of JV deal in 2010-11 with Aegon. As that started to unwind, I went to work at Aegon, became COO for Aegon and for the platform, did a whole bunch of stuff, mostly well, mostly good, mostly very proud of it. Got a few bumps in the way on for the advisor, certainly following the migration. So I left Aegon and actually left Aegon for personal reasons more than anything else. I lived away from home a long time. My son's now 20, 21, is at university. So, but at the time he was growing up and I was living in Edinburgh 4 days away, missing him growing up. Took a year off, which is the best thing I've ever done, the scariest thing I've ever done, but took a year off. Did a bit of work when I came back for private equity. So had an interesting experience within private equity and then started here working on a project for Rob Regan, who's my predecessor, great guy, actually. And as they say, the rest is history. Rob left and I became CEO. So that's where I am now. So that's the potted career history.
That sounds so interesting. You've kind of moved through different parts of financial services. What has that transition been like, you know, moving from insurance to pensions and now working in platforms?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, general insurance, I found it fascinating. I look back on that part of my career and think it was a different era at work, and the training that Prudential gave you was just amazing. So you start in the post room on purpose, even though that's not your job. You start, and then that was amazing. And kind of because they do such good training, and I mean I'm that old now. It's pre-computer, right?
So, right.
But for the house insurance, we were filling in policy record cards, and I'm left-handed. My handwriting's not the best, but it became. it got better. And that job was quite wide. It was everything from literally underwriting to accounts, rep paying, advisor commission, relationships with advisors. So that was good. So the move to life and pensions was surprisingly easy. But by then in my career, I was just doing operational change for the most part. So the kind of, you don't need to be a subject matter expert. If you're in a general insurance underwriter, you've got to be able to, you've got to be qualified, you've got to pass exams. Mm-hmm. So the general the life insurance part was a bit easier. Moving into platforms was, looking back, terrifying. I mean, Scandia had a platform then that had been around a few years, but that Celestia platform, which is what it was called, was just an amalgamation really of three types of people. Mm-hmm. You had people from asset management, so Brett from M&G, Bill was from M&G. You had a few of us from life and pensions backgrounds, really. So my boss, John, and then a bunch of IT people. So a bunch of kind of free thinking IT people that were interested in the internet and how you could do things on a more e-commerce basis. And I didn't, I think, looking back, appreciate what really a platform was. I had an idea. Mm-hmm. But at the time when we launched that business, we had 50 funds. If you think the average platform now has got something like 4,500.
Right.
We thought launching with 50 funds would be amazing. And platforms were called fund supermarkets really back then. So co-funds, before really platforms, the next evolution was kind of your Transact model, which became more about wealth platforms. That really, the business model then was quite simply that we went out to the fund managers and we got better pricing deals than advisors could. Mm-hmm. And amalgamated everything into a bunch of reporting and made it a lot easier for advisors and clients, a lot more cost effective to do that. But that was a tough transition. But I think 20 years later, it is 21, I think, this year. It's actually not hard. It's not hard, but I do respect if you're coming into it at the age I went into Prudential at 17. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to know and change.
Yeah, I find it so interesting that you were there basically like at the inception and when platforms were being built. I think that's a completely different process from kind of coming into it when there's a structure kind of in place. You're going in with the team of people trying to basically be architects for something that is moving forward. So you've kind of touched on that a little bit and how it was slightly difficult, but you had an idea. But what was it like kind of like figuring out exactly what was necessary to have, what you didn't need, what issues arose when you were building that? You know, what was that process like?
It has been really interesting because if you think in my career, I've kind of done effectively three startups. So Celestia was the first one, Novi was the second one. Mm-hmm. But building what Novi had built with Aegon was another startup inside a big corporate, really, because Aegon didn't have a platform and Aegon mm-hmm. at the time was a dominant player in the workplace pensions market and a big legacy provider. So they've all been different. The first one, Old Mutual funded it well, so we had decent budgets. I can't think of another phrase. One of the things that's good in a place like that is you get a small number of experts that stick to their knitting. So you know, if I think about Bill, for example, Bill's brilliant at marketing, Bill's brilliant at PR, brilliant at brand. Mm-hmm. Brett, you know, was it a natural thing for Bill to become a CEO of a platform at some point? Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, Brett as the MD of that business was just a brilliant loads of stuff, but really good at bringing disparate people together under a common purpose. So if you've got a leader like that that can galvanize you around a common purpose, and you know, and Brett's purpose is, I want to redefine the market here. We've got an opportunity to build a platform that's entirely based on e-commerce, that's really efficient, that's providing really high levels of service. And that was his vision, and he never moved away from it. And so I think that what's fabulous in that is it's a real adrenaline rush, right? It really is. You're breaking new ground every day, and you fail fast, actually. So it's more like a dot-com type, Silicon Valley type program, really, because you fail fast, because you can see immediately that you're doing something. So as an example of failing fast, we were really proud of these 50 funds, and the advisors went, nowhere near enough. You haven't got 500 funds, and you haven't got these particular funds. Go away and get them, and then come back and have a conversation. So you can fail fast. You can do things quickly. I remember got a complaint, a really horrible complaint from an advisor. Went to Brett.
Yeah,
I was running ops at the time, and the advisor complained that he hadn't got his commission statement, and he really went off on one about it. And Brett said, "That's absolutely fine. You'll never get another commission statement for us again because we post them all online. I didn't realise we were posting them by paper. We're not posting anything by paper again." You know, if I think to the kind of more Aegon and where M&G, we would never do that, right? There would be decision-making processes and committees and more collaboration to make that decision. But when you're in that kind of startup mode, it's different. So there's a first iteration was like Novia wasn't dissimilar, but when with Novia you own part of the company, so you're more aware you're spending your own money, and you're much more aware that if you run out of money you're writing a check to go to work, which is really counterintuitive. Say it's quite a surreal experience. So you get it, you kind of got that learning of having done it once before, but you get really, really laser sharp on what's important. You get much more discerning around people because you just can't afford to make people mistakes, because you're in a small business, you're in a startup. And what happened in both of those businesses is the dot-com bubble burst just after Celestia was launched, and then the credit crunch happened, the GFC happened just after Novia. So it's
a lot.
Yeah, both of them were really testing, but in both cases we built really good tech, and we'd recruited really well, and we had that's good vision. So you just got to be patient and stick to it. And then when you get into the kind of into Aegon was again a different experience. I mean, Aegon, when they did the due diligence on Novia, actually had more people doing the due diligence on us than we employed by some measure. So I think it's 50 or 60 people, and our headcount was only like 40. So you kind of learn, then you remember big corporate, so you remember where you've come from sort of 7 or 8 years earlier. And you understand the processes and everything that goes in it. But that's a different type of startup, because somebody else is writing you a bunch of checks, and they want to know what they're getting for their money, and they want to see evidence of it and milestones and all that stuff. So it's I'd never do another platform. So I'd never do another startup platform. Never.
No.
No.
I mean, the whole process of being a startup, it seems very romantic, right? Like, people like the idea. But from what I've seen, what I've read, it's a lot more painstaking and so many hours spent. And it's great to be able to make those quick decisions and maybe like readjust quickly. I think it's nice to have fallback, like someone to have as a backup plan.
I think the market's different as well. I mean, obviously Old Mutual back in 2001 was a big business, not very well known in the UK, but huge. I mean, I think at that point, somewhere in the region of 50 to 60% share of the African market. Massive business. We're very lucky to go to South Africa a lot, to Cape Town.
Yeah.
An Old Mutual park is literally as it, and it's got its own train station.
I grew up in Zimbabwe, and Old Mutual was like the bank that everyone used. It was funny moving to the UK, and it was like the only bank I recognized was Barclays. But Old Mutual wasn't really here. I definitely have growing up.
So that was a well-capitalized business and provided us with money. But I think the economics of a platform now are such that starting up that type of admin-only platform would be impossible. You'd never make money. You'd literally never make money. You see platforms now, moving towards vertically integrated model. I think there's different reasons for that. Things like consumer duty drive that, actually, but the advice gap drives that. So but ultimately, you know, if you're an administration only platform or trying to survive on 20 to 25 basis points, I mean, if you go back to that original startup business, Celesti, we were on 1.5%. That was the margin. You know, you're ostensibly doing the same set of services now at 20 basis points. That just isn't, you know, that's why I think it's driving quite a lot of diversification. So it's possible. So you can get, you know, a business, say, for example, JP Morgan have bought Nutmeg. JP Morgan are so big, they've got such a big balance sheet, they can take a very long-term view. The kind of view you take if you're a workplace pensions business, you can take a very long-term view that over the course of the next 10, 15 years, government will make pensions more compulsory and you'll get more and more members contributing more and more money. In a kind of platform market, especially if you look at platform, you look at Bella's Fundscape report and you look at the very basic crash in platform numbers for most of our competitors, and look at it being a simple I minus E business trying to exist on admin only going forward, I think it's nigh on impossible. I can't see how you can make the money. Tech hasn't got much cheaper. That's the irony of it. You know, we did a lot up with tech 20 years ago and some's got cheaper. You know, think about trading funds is a lot cheaper now than it was then. It's a lot more automated, but your basic cost of even a Microsoft license really isn't gone down, and so
more accessible, that's all.
It is more accessible. So I think the market's shifted forever, and I think it will continue to shift. I mean, people talk about consolidation of platforms, and definitely private equity has helped that a lot, because the private equity businesses just take a view. I've got a model. The model is it needs to give me that internal rate of return. So, you know, they're not, I think people often confuse them with venture capital businesses, and that's not what a private equity is. A private equity business is trying to get a hurdle rate of return for its investors. So say 10%. And they again will take a different view. So if you look at Nucleus and James Hay, Epirus are taking a view of a hurdle rate, and to get to that hurdle rate, they've done a deal with that FNZ to outsource the administration and IT at a fixed cost, and their numbers inside their own model will say that they can make that economically work. I don't know whether they can or not, I'm not making a judgment on the model, but the private equity businesses, they're kind of buy, consolidate, and then flip model will deliver the short-term returns for private equity. It's not what we're about. We're about a different concept. We're about long-term stability, got a good balance sheet. We've got a lot of things that we can offer into the market. So we will take a longer-term view of things. You know, it's difficult market conditions at the moment, but we'll not react. We don't need to worry, you know, It's not a balance sheet problem for M&G PLC. So I think consolidation will happen in and around platforms, because PE firms still see the long-term trend in the UK as moving towards wealth management, and they can take the view that that's the long-term dynamic, so they can make some short-term money. That will fuel consolidation. But I still think that a market that's, what, 800 billion, there's plenty of room in the market for platforms.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on the evolution that platforms have made in the last two decades, you know, from when you started to now?
I mean, I think, what do I think? Evolution, I mean, we would never, if you go back to, if you think of a value chain, so if you think of the different aspects of a value chain, and you go back to when I started doing this, we'd never have contemplated owning an advice business. Interestingly enough, Old Mutual bought Scandia. Scandia owned Bank Hall, but Old Mutual sold Bank Hall because the Old Mutual strategy wasn't to own an advice business. That was
right.
But Scats, you know, Scandia and Old Mutual both had asset managers. So that was always, there was always a closer link between a platform and an asset manager. And you see that now, actually. You see Fidelity, Schroders, you see M&G. So I can see much, and you've seen much more natural synergy take place between platforms and asset managers. And increasingly, though, if you don't have some form of distribution that and and I use the word advisedly on control, but if you don't have some sort of distribution where you can work really closely with that distributor and get the volumes into the platform and volumes into asset solutions and take money off of each part of that value chain, the economics are really quite hard. That's been the difference. I think you go back to in the start of this, you could, and take to look at Transact. Transact, a phenomenal business. Mm-hmm. Transact floated at a really high share price. That whole market, that kind of tech type market, has come off a lot, but Transact share price is off a lot as well. And Transact have just launched what they've done with BlackRock, and I think that's good and that's smart. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it doesn't, as an organization, its margins are coming under pressure and its costs are going up. And you see that if you look at the analyst reports in and around Transact, the analysts worry that Transact are under margin pressure and the costs are going up because inflation and a whole bunch of other thing, and it suppresses their share price. That's the difference. But you could go back even 10 years now, and you could still see a lot of value being created in those admin only platforms. But I think I think it's less now.
Yeah, I think so. And also, you mentioned before, you touched on Consumer Duty a little bit with the talk about vertical integration. But how else do you see Consumer Duty kind of affecting platforms?
Yeah, I'll choose something slightly different. So as a platform SIP provider, mm-hmm. and as a platform provider, we're subject to the ICARA regime. So previously it was ICAP, so capital adequacy. It's an FCA framework for ensuring we had sufficient capital to operate our business. And there's some scenarios in there. One of the scenarios is a wind down scenario. So in that, typically you'd hold between 3 and 6 months of operating costs as cash in order to wind the business down if you decided to close it. That's typically what would happen in ICAP. Mm-hmm. ICARA and similarly Consumer Duty and the regulator are looking much more at risks and harms. So under ICARA, the whole thing is about the risks that I foresee as a CEO of a platform in running a platform to our customers. Mm-hmm. So that's a risk of an IT provider failing. That's a risk of a massive market downturn. That's a risk of a change in strategy or something happening. We have to look at that, and we have to hold a lot of regulatory capital now, much more so than, say, Celestia 20 years ago. And that's been a deliberate policy from the regulator to stabilize this part of the market, to say, mm-hmm. you have to hold more capital because it's not realistic. You've got 17 billion of money rich. You look after 100 or 1,000 customers, you can't wind that down in 3 months. Don't be silly. It's that kind of, and that flows through, that regulatory philosophy flows through into Consumer Duty. My job, our job, is to look at foreseeable harms. So for customers in a product, take for example, if a customer comes to us, more globally within M&G, and they've mm-hmm. got 100,000, and we know that's all they've got in their pension pot, and that mm-hmm. customer says, I'm going to take 20 grand a year. We know that customer is going to run out of money in 5 years. Now, it's their money. We would make no judgment. But mm-hmm. our responsibility is to see there's a foreseeable harm of a customer at, say, 55, spending their entire pension pot in 5 years. We will have Consumer Duty, write to them, contact them. If they've got an advisor, it's unlikely the advisor wouldn't advise that, right?
Right.
But we would contact that customer, and we would engage with that customer because you can see it as a foreseeable harm. So Consumer Duty flows through the whole regulatory framework, and it's about, instead of it's there's rules and there's a rule book there, but we have to think much more about our interactions with advisors and customers and that. And I always think of it as a foreseeable harm. So the things that the behaviors of our products, our funds, the things that we can facilitate, mm-hmm. how that has an impact on the end customer. And to some extent over the years, we've had to do that. We have to provide a statutory money purchase illustration annually. We have to provide statements to customers. If there's under MiFID, if there's a drop of more than 10%, we have to write to customers. And we'll continue to do all of that. But you need to look at each of those things and see whether you can enhance any of that reporting, whether you're missing any reporting, whether there's any things. And then also you need to look at vulnerability. So vulnerability in its widest sense, not just kind of disability vulnerability, but more about somebody's vulnerability around money. Do they understand? And so if you're now sitting in the call center on the platform and you get it's there now with vulnerability, but with Consumer Duty, and you can clearly tell that that particular customer just doesn't understand and they are vulnerable in that, we have a much more of a statutory obligation. It's really not a bad thing. It's a really good thing. I think the thing that I find fascinating, and the penny's dropping in, it's been with me since the regs came out. This isn't like MiFID, and it isn't like RDI. It isn't a fire and forget. You know, the rule book changes and you do a whole bunch of stuff. This Consumer Duty is here to stay.
Ongoing.
Consumer Duty phase one, there'll be phase two, three, four, five, and six. Mm-hmm. And the regulator will continue to raise the bar and raise the standard, and that can't be a bad thing.
No, I think as it's looking after the consumer, that's the most important part. So obviously as CEO, you've said that you look ahead in your model and like how you lead and everything. But so what are your hopes? Where do you want to lead, you know, your team and the platform? What are you hoping to achieve without spilling too many secrets?
I'll name drop somebody actually, and I saw him last week for a beer. Martin Jennings at Parmenia, and he's local to me anyway. Martin and I share the same philosophy and vision, really. And actually, Jackie Boylan does at Fidelity, to be fair. And I guess probably Jonathan at Transact. Ultimately, I've taken a view a platform does one thing. You take money in, look after it for a while, and do what people want with it, and then you give it them back, right? So my hopes and aspirations are we get better at helping people transfer their money in, because that process is still slow and clunky, and it causes dissatisfaction. I think we've always been all right at looking after it and doing what people want to do with it, but we got to get a lot better at giving back and transferring. That really still is. It's prehistoric. If you look at some of the transfer times in and out, and if you look at some of the paperwork and some of the problems that customers and advisors go through 20 years, the levels of automation, and that, you know, we've done a lot of work, and we started on money out, and I wish I could tell you honestly, hand on heart, we did it because I altruistically believe that we should start there. We did it because we were at the time sending a lot of money out, and it was our highest volume process, but we have spent a lot of time automating that and making the transfer of units and money. So that's my big hope. My big hope is that for our platform, our service continues to get better, and the investments M&G in it pay off. My hope for the platform industry is that all the uncertainty and change of ownership and problems, structural problems, don't cause a deterioration in service for customers, and that people just remember that that's what you do. You take money and look after it, give it back. Mm-hmm. So service, really, that's my first thing. I mean, we've got some, I don't know what I can say, what can I say? We've got some really interesting, we put Pru-Fund on platform this year. That's interesting to see how advisors are using that and using it alongside other assets and alongside model portfolios as part of an asset allocation. That's quite interesting. So I think we've got some good hopes and expectations. We're going to spend quite a bit of time and money on deeper back office integration. We've got we own Sandringham, and we've got eventually we'll own Continuum. So, you know, we're going to have 1,000 advisors near enough. So 1,000 internal people to pick, but there's a lot of work to that point about what you do as a platform. There's a lot of work we can do with IntelliFlow, with Iris and the back office providers to deepen that, to not make it such swivel chair, to not make the reliance on our own websites, but use that. So that of a kind of things that I'm interested in work-wise, that's one of the big things that we'll be doing is spending time and money building out some good, like Jackie started at Fidelity, some of the stuff that Fidelity are doing on the advisor solutions, it's really good. So it's not an area, Kimberly, you trailblaze in particularly, but it's an important one. Consumer Duty is big. consumer duty, we've got a fairly short period of time in which to do it. But if you look at, before you, I came off a call, if you look at the majority of our roadmap spending, and we've got a decent level of funding from M&G, it's good old-fashioned, relatively dull for some, but interesting for me, ops and customer service improvement. That's the main things we're looking at. This is I think that's where you differentiate. I think it's why Transact still top the leaderboards for the most part. I mean, I get that you've got true potential in there, but that's a different model.
I think that from the feedback that I hear, the biggest complaint is always on the customer service side. I think the focus on that would make sense.
Yeah, and Ian Taylor, God rest his soul, was always brilliant at that. Ian never, that kind of simple philosophy of what a platform is, Ian never moved away from it. And the consistent levels of service from Transact from the day they started is, I've never been able to repeat it, and I've had a reasonably decent career and I've had a good go at it from time to time. But you know, that for M&G, that's our main ambition really, is to get our service to end to end. So from the advisor through platform into any asset solutions, and not to force advisors to use things. I mean, if an advisor wants to come to us and use PruFund, they can. If they don't, they want to use the rest of it, they can. You know, we're not there saying that's what you must use all this part of the value chain. That would be really mad.
Yeah. And finally, I wanted to ask, someone in your position, being a CEO and probably overlooking, you know, a very big team and having to make a lot of decisions, what skill set, what do you think is important to have in terms of knowledge, soft skills, what is necessary to be in a position like yours?
A bit of luck.
I mean, luck is great, but you also need other things, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I think, I left school at 16 for different reasons. And I've always just worked hard. And I think technology's come in. And as people, you know, the general level of people we get into the business, I wouldn't get a job here now because I didn't get enough qualifications. But there isn't any substitute. So I still believe in hard work. But for me now in this job, as much as you want to touch and affect the hundreds of people that are in the business directly, you can do that, but you can walk around the office and you can definitely do that. It's much more about my team. It's much more about the team I work in within M&G, actually. So my peer group but it's about managing my team and making sure they're doing the right things with their people, making sure we've got, I'm not just saying this, M&G's got a really good culture. We've got some really good programs in place across a range of things, from diversity inclusion through to support for menopause, mental health and well-being programs, and they're all very natural and very very well supported and genuinely supported by the business. So we don't have a challenge particularly in that space, but my challenge is to motivate and manage the team of people that work for me, and actually to some extent a team of people directly under them to manage wider teams. So you kind of,
it filters down.
It's like kind of that pay it forward thing, and you need to have really big ears. You need to be able to listen, and you need to be able to work out what's, from all of the information that you get, what's really important and what's the things that you need to cut through in order to make decisions. So I'm really lucky. The platform team I've got they're a superb team. And I can say that because I'm sitting looking at some of their year-end appraisal ratings.
That's great.
But yeah, I think that's the main challenge. I think the best people I've worked with, I mean, if I go back to the start of platforms, I look at Brett Williams. I think Brett's probably the best man manager I've ever worked for. And Brett could get the best out of his direct report team and the team of people underneath them by creating that supportive culture, that vision. And so I think as much as the world's changing, as much as technology's coming in, as much as my son at 20's got completely different ideas of work, I still think some good old-fashioned people management and some good old-fashioned hard work's probably still going to win through.
I think we're a different generation, and I would agree. It is all about those people skills, listening, and also, you know, working hard. It is very important. But thank you so much for speaking with me, Richard. I learned a lot personally, and I hope that our audience also learns a lot.
Good. Lovely to meet you, and have a good evening.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. See you later.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation With. We do hope that you enjoyed it. Please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. You can also keep up to date with all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as our print edition Money Marketing magazine. So make sure to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. See you next time.